Welcome to Visible by Numbers with your host, Allison Bachman.
Hello and welcome to Visible by Numbers, being broadcast on beautiful BBS Radio, the number one radio station on the internet. And this is your host, Allison. Once again, I thank you for being here, and I'm always happy that you decided to spend your evening with me. Few things up before I get to my guest. Make sure that if you aren't already signed up for my newsletter, to get on my website and sign up for it, because the newsletter is coming out the first of the month, and of course the monthly forecast will be in it, your numerology monthly forecast. So make sure you visit www.visiblebynumbers.com and look for the sign up box so you can get the newsletter. And it's also going to tell you about my upcoming guests and what's new and some really valuable numerology insight as well. Also, this week I've got a workshop coming up on the 31st. It's called Identify Your Heart's Desire and Follow Your Greatest Joy. It's at the Circle of Miracles in New Britain, Pennsylvania. And I'm also going to be doing some numerology readings, private readings afterwards. So if you're interested in attending the workshop, and of course I'd love to meet you, so please check out Susan Duval Seminars. And her website is SusanDuvalSeminars.com. And you can get that information on the info link for Visible by Numbers on the front page of BBS Radio. And also, there's some information there about the second annual Lightworkers Joy Retreat, which is going to take place October 8th through the 11th. And so you might be interested in that, so check it out. And that's on the info page for Visible by Numbers. Okay, so I am just delighted to bring Shirley Edenbrad to the show this evening. She is beyond brave. She's the brave and loving mother of Corey. She's the author of Over the Rainbow Bridge, which is an inspirational book about Corey's life, his journey with cancer from the age of 3 to his death at age 9. Over the Rainbow Bridge, for me at least, was incredibly moving. I laughed, I cried, I was inspired, and I fell in love with Corey and Shirley. And by the time it was all said and done, I felt as though I connected with Corey's spirit as I read it. And I can see from the testimonials on Shirley's website that I'm not the only one that felt that way. And I got to tell you, it's my complete pleasure to welcome Shirley to the show and introduce her and Corey to all of you. Shirley, welcome to Visible by Numbers, and thank you so much for being here tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to share Corey's messages.
Wow, he was an incredible, incredible child. And the book really, you know, I do a lot of interviews. I have a lot of books. I have stacks of them I have to read. Some of them I look forward to. Some of them I have to wade through. And I have to say that your book, I couldn't put it down. I was just, once I picked it up and once I started reading it, I just couldn't put it down. So, you know, kudos to you for being, I think real is a word that I would use. I think you were able to translate emotions, your emotions. I think you were able to translate so many things into your words that it made it an incredibly, the book that pulled you in and it really moved you. And so, you know, you're really a wonderful writer.
Oh, thank you.
Right.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But you also had great inspiration.
I did. My life's work there.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing that I can remember in the beginning part of the book when you were talking about Corey before he became ill, just in his infancy and as he started, even the first day you brought him home from the hospital, for goodness sake, but talk about how, what on fast pace Corey was from the moment of birth.
Well, he was shocking because I had to have an emergency cesarean. So we spent the first week in the hospital, but I didn't get to see him for a couple days. So the first time I had a chat with him, I had him sitting on my belly, and I had a pillow over it to protect my incision. And he grabbed both of my thumbs, and he stood up, arched his back, and he looked me straight in the eye, and he smiled at me.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, my gosh, I don't think babies can do this. You know, what is going on here? So he definitely was in fast forward. He started crawling when he was 3 months old. And, you know, most babies aren't even turning over yet.
True.
Yeah, he was scooting across his blanket to get to his toys. I just had him across the blanket so that he'd have something interesting to look at while I ran in the next room. And I came back, and he's playing with the toys. And I thought, well, that doesn't make sense. So I put him back in the other opposite corner, and I sat down, and I watched him, and he scooted on his belly across the blanket and grabbed the toy. And I thought, oh, my gosh. So I did it again because I thought I was seeing things. And he pulled the blanket and grabbed the toy. He didn't even bother crawling. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this child is using logic and reasoning, and, you know.
Very early age.
Yeah, he was highly intelligent and definitely in fast forward.
Definitely. And he did incredible things as far as his speech development, his walking, everything. It was just, these would be the kind of things that you would tell people, and they'd say, yeah, sure, you're just the mom, and you're just a little bit over anxious. But he really did these things, right?
He really did these things, and there was plenty of witnesses. But he, you know, he figured out how to pull the drawers out next to the refrigerator because the cookie jar was on top of the refrigerator.
Right.
So he pulled the drawers. This is a baby. He was maybe 9 months old. He pulled the drawers out, climbed up the drawers, got on the counter, opened the cupboard, and then climbed the shelves and then hoisted himself onto the top of the refrigerator.
And you just about died when you found him there, right?
I came around the corner and saw him sitting up there, and I just thought, oh, my gosh, don't jump. Because he thought he was invincible anyway. So I put my hands up, and I said, you know, don't move. And I got him down, and I said, what are you doing? Because I was totally freaked out. So I sat down in the middle of the kitchen with him and told him that he was not to do that again. And he said, but how am I supposed to get the cookies when you're not here?
At 9 months, he said, how am I supposed to get the cookies when you're not here? And most kids can barely say, dad, dad, mama, right?
I know. He was just amazing. And when he was 15 months old, he could identify, I think even before that, he could identify all, I have five brothers and two sisters. Mm-hmm. He knew which cousins went with which aunt and uncle. I mean, most kids don't even know that stuff.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's totally amazing. So from the get-go, he was an unusual child, and that's an understatement, I would say to say, right?
Really,
safe
yeah.
to say, okay. But let's take it back just a little bit and then go into your youth and into a premonition that you had, and maybe talk about that for a moment.
Well, when I was about 10, we lived in California, and we were driving along Half Moon Bay, and it has that sort of rolling ground fog in the mornings.
Sure.
And we were driving along, and I looked out the window, and this poem came to me, and I had this vision of, you know, fog kind of swirling around a tombstone. So I wrote a poem about it, and my mom found it later and totally freaked out. She thought I was depressed or, you know, whatever, because kids weren't supposed to think about death and cemeteries. And so she asked me about it, and I said, you know, when I grow up, I'm going to have a sick child, and the child's going to die, and together we're going to teach people not to be afraid of death. And she was like, what? So at first she said, are you sure it's not going to be you that gets sick? And I said, no, it's going to be my child. And then a couple years later, when my favorite uncle got sick with cancer, he was the first one in our family, in a huge family, but I'd never heard the term before. My uncle, my aunt called, and she was crying and telling my parents that her husband was very ill. Mm-hmm. And so when I heard the word, it kind of triggered something, and I went to my mom, and I said, that's what my child is going to have. Mm-hmm. And she said, oh, wow. So, you know, then you try to file it away and not think about it. So when I was pregnant, I was a little nervous, but I kind of put it in the back of my head. And when he was born, he was an emergency C-section, like I said. He was so healthy and so robust. But when he started showing signs of being in fast forward, I kind of knew he was the one.
You knew he was the one, right? So you had your own premonition about it. So this was definitely, you know, something that there was so much spiritual, and there was so much about this whole journey for you, for him, and the message. And one of the things that, you know, that I'm a numerologist, and you also know that primarily on this show we do a lot of shows about numerology. We teach about it. We have a lot of people that are interested in it that listen. And the one thing that I did was I looked at both Shirley's and Corey's numbers because I was fascinated and I wanted to know. And I have to say that you know, Corey was a messenger. He's a master 11 expression number, and oft times 11s come into this world, they do have electric personalities. They are high gear. But they have a purpose, and his mission in life was a purpose, and it was to give a message to humanity. And certainly through his life and what he taught everyone, not only in living but also dying, he certainly delivered that message. The other thing about Corey that I love is that he's an eight life path, and eight life paths tend to never give up. They never say never. They tend to, like, onward, forward, get over it, move on. They're some of the bravest, the most strongest. They call them the survivors. And oftentimes, eights end up having very difficult circumstances in their life. And part of the purpose is to be a demonstration to the rest of the world. You know, like when we feel like we can't take it anymore, we look at someone else's life. You know how that always goes. Somebody's always got it worse than you, right? Well, it always seems to be the eight that has it worse than you, and they're the ones that inspire you because despite what happened in their life, they got on with the business of life. They managed to survive it. Well, you and Corey both share that number. You both shared that number. It's also in your chart as well. And so I really can see so much of the numerology and the fact that you were a brilliant writer and the fact that you were able to infuse your words with your emotions, because that's really, you know, your three birthday, three expression, and that's what it's all about. It's about the gift of words. So much reflected in your numerology charts. And of course, as a numerologist, you know, I'm loving that, right?
That's totally amazing.
Yeah.
Totally. It really does describe him so much.
Right. Well, he was amazing. Now, tell everyone about, well, I don't even know where to begin, but Corey, you know, as you were going through the process of discovery that he had cancer, and certainly that's not a pretty treatment for leukemia. It's a very difficult treatment. And just, what did he teach you? What did he teach you about living and dying that you could put into words to share with the audience?
Well, excuse me, the main thing that he taught me was that to value the time that you have, no matter how much time you're given. And that was really his message to everybody that he encountered, whether it was a classmate or teacher or a doctor or a nurse or other sick kids. And he lived every moment with joy and gratitude. So that's one of the key things that he taught me, is to not take life for granted, and that, you know, everything can turn on in a second.
Sure.
And so to live the best life you can, no matter how much time you're given. And the other thing that he taught me was that not to sweat the little stuff. I mean, that really is it for me. I mean, I have been involved with the community festival this past week, and it's been really hectic, and there has been a lot of squabbling because everybody's tired and it's unseasonably hot here. And I listened to these parents complain about such minutia. I just wanted, one woman, I looked at her and I said, you know, I was at Children's Hospital the other day and holding the hand of a little boy who's dying. You know, come on, put this in perspective. And
right.
That's really what Corey taught me.
Sure.
What's important. And the other thing that he taught people, which was hilarious, we got invited to speak to some students at a alternative school, and most of them were high school age, and we walked in, and here's this little eight-year-old, and a young man raised his hand, and he said, how does it feel to know that you're dying? Now, Corey wasn't diagnosed as terminal at that point, but he knew, because he was intuitive, and he just looked at him, and he said, you know, that's not really the important thing. He said, the important question is, how do you feel about living? Everybody just went quiet. All the adults in the room started crying, and the young man was just stunned. He didn't know what to say. So that's when Corey, you know, said, look, you've got to live your life the best way you can and be the best person that you can be, and know that when you die, that you've done the world a service and that you lived the best life you could.
Right, right.
You know, don't die with regrets. So his other message for people not to fear death is that, you know, he totally believed that if you live in fear, you're not going to live fully. And what a ripoff that is, and you're doing it to yourself.
Sure.
So that was a very important message that he conveyed to people, too.
Right, right. And in his book, well, throughout the book, there's so many things that Corey said that were beyond his age and wisdom.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the things, you know, you really need to think about and think that this came from the mouth of a babe, more or less. And it certainly is a lesson for a person of any age. Now, another thing that Corey did that was unusual, of course, he was unusual from birth, but he also left his body. He actually visited heaven. You want to share that just a little bit with everyone?
Sure. Well, before he did that even, he was, I think what they call it is astral projection. Mm-hmm. He would come down in the morning and tell me that he was running on the beach, you know, in Maui or Tahiti or wherever he wanted to go that night. And he'd wake up and go, gosh, I'm really tired. He said, but I had a great time. But then when he got closer to being towards the end, for the last year and a half of his life, he went out of body and went to the other side over the Rainbow Bridge, which is why I made the title that way. And he came back with incredible stories about what he saw and heard there. But he also brought back messages from people that he didn't even know, people that had died before he was born. Mm-hmm. And so I was constantly writing down messages and giving them to people that I thought could handle it. And there's quite a few kids that had died before him that were treated at the same hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So those messages I gave to the parents via the social worker.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And so some of them actually showed up at Corey's service and thanked me.
Right.
For sending them the messages.
Right.
But he was really intent on describing, and he tried to draw. The drawing that he did that's in the book, unfortunately it's not in color, but that was done when he was 7 when he first started going out of body.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about the colors of the rainbow and the colors on the other side being not of this earth.
Sure.
And he said the music that he heard was so beautiful, incredibly beautiful. He said it was the music of the angels. And he said, you've never heard it here before because, you know, they don't live here.
Mm-hmm.
And he drew a picture of a crystal castle that he said where God lives, which is right on the other side of the Rainbow Bridge,
mm-hmm.
which he said rainbows are actually bridges from here to heaven. It's the side view of the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And so he said, whenever you see a rainbow, that means somebody's crossing over.
Oh.
And he said that there was smaller castles and cottages, and everything was made of faceted crystal, and they reflected the colors of the rainbow. Because he said everything in heaven is made from light energy, including the beings. And he said, you know, people there communicate by thought, and that it is a place where it never rains. The sun is always shining, which cracks me up because you can tell that he was raised in the Northwest. But I just recently found out, after going to Lilydale, New York, I bought a book about Lilydale. I don't know if you've been there.
Yes,
but
yes.
The book, I think in about 70 pages, the author talks about heaven, and she said, or Summerland, as the spiritualists call it. Well, you know, Corey wasn't a spiritualist, but that's what he called it. So
sure.
It just blew my mind. And,
well, not only that, but the information about the colors, the music... That's been validated in several other venues of people describing it the exact same way. So, I mean, you know, it's consistent. It's very consistent.
Yeah, it wasn't like it just came
out
of
it. And he didn't have any way of knowing. It was just his perception from his experience.
Yeah, and he was basically unchurched.
Unchurched.
Because we didn't go to church because I was afraid of germs.
Uh-huh.
And even though my grandfather was a Methodist minister and we were... had spent our early childhood with him. We weren't really big churchgoers.
Uh-huh.
And so when Corey was sick, of course, I didn't want him around crowds. So even though his dad wanted to take him to the Catholic Church, I didn't let him because I was afraid of his immune system being so suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
So he really, I mean, the experiences that he described really came from his spiritual knowledge of the things that occurred to him.
Sure, absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. And there's so much validation in that as you read that because it's, you know, multiple places the same information comes from when people describe their experience in heaven. As a matter of fact, I interviewed a man named Russell Forsythe that died and spent a great deal of time in heaven before he came back. And if you re-listen to his interview, that's exactly what he's talking about as well. So, you know, there's a lot of validation there, but it came from Corey. It didn't come from any other source, which was amazing. And one of the pictures that he drew actually has been turned into an inspirational poster that's actually in treatment centers for children. Is that true?
Yes, we created the poster years ago from his drawing. And sold them to help fund scholarships for the Kubler-Ross grief workshops for children and teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
that we were doing back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And it's just amazing because I met a doctor from Sydney, Australia that has one in his office.
Isn't that amazing? Yes.
And
now, go ahead.
Well, Elizabeth sold them all over the world at her grief workshops.
Sure. Now, explain who, that's what I was going to say, to explain who Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was and what her relationship was with Corey.
Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is the doctor that wrote On Death and Dying and 15 other books about the dying process. And she actually single-handedly is responsible for all of the thanatology courses around the world, I believe. In the early 60s, she started actually listening to dying patients. Mm-hmm. And she was shunned by her peers in the medical profession because they all kind of just ignored people that were dying.
Mm-hmm.
And they would always put them in the last room at the end of the hallway. Mm-hmm. And these poor people died without being able to finish their business. So that was her mission in life, was to teach healthcare professionals and other people not to be afraid of dying patients and to actually listen to what they had to say.
Mm-hmm.
So we were invited to do a teaching video with her at the University of Washington mm-hmm. when Corey was 7, and they just fell in love with each other. It was immediate. Mm-hmm. And she also bonded with my mom and, you know, to some extent me and my daughter as well. But we did this fabulous video for the medical ethics department at the med school at UW, and she would call him out of the blue. It was almost like they had this psychic connection, because whenever he was stressing about something physical going wrong with his body, she would happen to call and she'd give him a pep talk and then he'd be okay.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So they just had this fabulous thing, and one of the last thing messages he gave me before he died was to tell Elizabeth that he could no longer wait for her phone call, but mm-hmm. that he would be beside her at the speed of thought.
Oh,
and she called a couple days after he passed away, and she said, first thing she said to me was, he's gone, and I said, yeah, and she said, did it happen? And she pinpointed the time. She was in Austria doing a workshop. She pinpointed the exact time that he died because she felt his presence with her.
Sure.
Because she was talking to her workshop participants about him.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm.
She... the two of them together were quite something.
And going back to her work, and certainly going back to Corey's message, that the one thing that has always struck me, and not just recently but for years, was that we spend so much time talking about how to avoid death,
mm-hmm.
how to stay healthy, young, vibrant, but we don't, as a society, we don't spend enough time talking about what is everyone was born to do. I mean, eventually, we all will eventually die at some point in our lives. And the information of how to go about that and what is the process. And someone like Corey, I mean, I found that to be inspirational to do it with such panache, first and foremost, with such courage. And also, I think the aspects of him being a child and being forced into medical situations where they ignored him like he didn't exist and just mm-hmm. like he was a pincushion, and how he demanded that they acknowledge that he was a human being undergoing this experience, not just a patient or a number. And also, you know, things like that about Corey just I found so incredibly inspirational. And I feel that he has added to the conversation through your book, you taking the time to write it, but also through his experience, added to the conversation about death itself, you know, to help us, because we need to make it something we can talk about. You understand
right.
what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
Well, and that is really an extension of his relationship with Elizabeth as well.
Sure.
You know, because one of the things he said to me was that he picked me to be his mom
mm-hmm.
because he was supposed to help put me on my path, which was to help Elizabeth teach people not to be afraid of death.
Sure.
And so, you know, he knew that through his death that I would have to carry that on because, you know,
sure.
he wouldn't be able to. You know, that wouldn't be the message anymore if he was
right.
still alive. So together, I think they had similar paths. And I just recently, someone called to my attention that there's a book that she wrote after he died, about 9 years later, that I never saw or heard of, called The Tunnel in the Light, which is a compilation of some of the stuff that she had already published. But she added a little mini chapter about Corey.
Uh-huh.
And it was so funny because... you know, she'd had several strokes by then. And so some of the information that she wrote is off number-wise, like his mm-hmm. age and stuff like that. But it's and she spelled his name wrong. She put two R's in it. But she did talk about him going out of body and going to the other
sure.
side and
sure.
going over the bridge.
Well, what I want to do is I just want to take a moment right now, and I just want to give people your website because, you know, this book, you can purchase it from your website, and I think that everyone might be interested in knowing what that is. So go ahead and give everyone your website.
Sure. It's overtherainbowbridge.info,
mm-hmm.
and I'll run together over the Rainbow Bridge in smaller case.
Right, and then people, if you're interested in just linking to it, if you didn't get that written down, if you just go to the front page of BBS Radio, click on the info tab in front of Visible by Numbers on Monday nights, you will see Shirley's picture of the book, and certainly the link to the website. But it's overtherainbowbridge.info, and you can order the book there. And I really can't recommend it enough. Personally, because I just found it in the story of Corey. He's engaging, he's an imp, he's trouble, he's intelligent, he's probably every mother's worst nightmare. I don't even know how you managed to get to be, you know, without gray hair, because I would have just probably had a nervous breakdown raising him. But he was an incredible child. And you know, I do feel, I mean, I know that at this, if Corey was alive today, he'd be 34 years old, and I know that there's an ending to your story. But I do feel that when I was reading that book, I so felt, I was infused with his energy. I was infused with his, the spirit of him, you know, almost as though he was like making sure, are you getting it? Are you getting my message, you know? And I was just, the love that flowed from me, you know, to both of you. You, my dear, I have to say, you are one tough cookie, first and foremost. The things that you had to deal with his treatment, just life itself, cars breaking down, carrying sick, dying, you know, kids to the hospital in the rain. I mean, girl, how did you keep your wits about you? How did you keep yourself from crumbling through all of that?
I think because I'm an eight. Aren't I an eight?
You're a fighter. Yeah, you're a fighter, but my God.
Yeah. Well, I didn't really have much choice, Allison.
I know, but...
I had to just do what had to be done.
You did, and yes, okay, you're an eight. Yes, okay, yeah. We know the numbers, but oh, my God. I myself, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, Allison, you are a marshmallow compared to this woman, you know? I'm like, Shirley could take you in a heartbeat, you know? She could take you down because she's one tough girl. I mean, you... The strength, and then I know there was probably times, and then I know that there were times where emotionally your vulnerability came through, like you just couldn't take it anymore, or where it overcame you at certain points, but you just kept getting up and you kept slugging, and I found myself in deep admiration of you as a human being, as a person, and what you had to do, and almost single-handedly do, you know, and thank God for the love and the support of your friends. But God, you yourself, that was, you know, must have taken quite a toll on you.
You know, it's that old adage about what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And I always felt bad for people because I've been doing bereavement support ever since.
Sure, I
and the parents that I meet that don't have other children, so they're no longer parents. They're no longer moms or dads.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's that whole thing where, gosh, I'm so lucky compared to them kind of thing. But I had a younger child, and, you know, I just had to keep going because of her. But I just remember being so exhausted after about 4 months after he was gone is when I finally started feeling like, oh, now I can grieve. And I just think, you know, people have funerals too soon. I think they should wait until they can actually feel it.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just my opinion.
No, I agree. I think that is a process that's individual to each person, and I can remember that in my course of my work that quite often I'm talking to someone that lost a child, and sometimes they're still in that place of grief, and I can remember thinking to myself, how can I possibly impart to this person any words of comfort because I myself don't know what this feels like. I have no idea, no concept to what it would be like to lose a child and how fortunate and blessed I am that I can say that.
Mm-hmm.
And I always felt inept, like I absolutely am inept at trying to connect to your pain. And a book like this, I would think, for someone that has lost a child, you know, that they read this story and that would be something that would give them the strength, you know, or someone that is dealing with a child that does have, you know, terminal illness or even is ill and potentially could recover, that your book is inspirational, you know, your strength and Corey's story. This can help so many people, and that's why I think the book is so important.
Sure.
And that's why I wanted to bring you on the show. I do want to take a moment, and I want to let our callers know that they're more than welcome to call in. Maybe you have a question that you would like to ask Shirley or have a comment about the conversation that we're having, and you're more than welcome to call in with your comments. I'll give you the toll-free numbers. You can call in at 888-815-9756. You can call in at 530-327-7602. 530-776-5185 and 530-413-4522. And if you didn't get those numbers, again, go to the front page of VBS Radio. Just look for the numbers under Station 1, and you can give us a buzz and let us know what you think. Shirley, when you were discussing, you know, you yourself, you do bereavement counseling, okay? And so this really... Corey's experience not only was part of your life, but it also became part of your path. And, you know, how do you feel that this experience gives you particular insight? Because like I said, I feel inept sometimes. And that do these people know what you've gone through? Do you share that with them when you're trying to help them?
Only if I feel like it'll help them. Sometimes... people have a hard time hearing that that I've had after-death contact with Corey.
Uh-huh.
Because he came to me quite a bit at the beginning.
Sure.
And if they haven't had that experience, then they get kind of unhappy about it. You know, because it's like, why was your child so open with you? Or even just during the dying process, you know, because he and I talked and talked and talked. And they didn't get that, maybe. And so I'm very careful about how much to share and when to share it.
Sure.
And if they ask me, I'll tell them. But usually, you know, the biggest thing I try to tell people is that, you know, grief is not a mental illness. It is a condition that was caused by something that happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, you can get through it. And if you need medication, it would be short term. It's not going to be a lifetime thing, you know, unless you allow it to be.
Sure.
And, you know, there are people that have complicated grief where that becomes who they are,
mm-hmm.
is the mother or father, mostly mothers, of a dead child. And mm-hmm. they feel like if they let go of that grief, it's letting go of the child.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the folks that I try to spend extra time with because, they don't understand that that's not what their child would want for them.
Sure. Well,
you know,
even in a parent that has a living child, okay,
mm-hmm.
it's a very difficult thing when your child gets to that age where you've put your lifeblood, your tears, your heart into that child, and now you've got to let them go. And, you know, that sometimes can cause a crisis, empty nest syndrome, or whatever you want to call it in a person's life, that you have to redefine who you are minus the children, because now you've got to find you because you don't have them to preoccupy you anymore, and it's about you finding who you are. And so I can understand that in the loss of a child being stuck in that place,
mm-hmm.
because in their mind that child is always a child. The child didn't go through that normal process of growing up and moving on with their lives, but that child just was taken from them. So I can understand where you would get stuck in that energy and stuck in that
mm-hmm.
place of grief. And I think grief, from what I've seen with people, is there's no definition of time to it. There's no, like, sometimes we get impatient. 6 months seems like long enough. You should be over it by now. But there's never a getting over it.
No,
it's always there inside of you. And,
right.
And you
like
have
that
to,
hole in your heart will always be there. You just get used to the pain.
Right.
That's what I tell people, and that's the honest truth.
It is. you know, I understand that. I understand that completely. Now, as I said, Corey would be 34 years old now. Isn't that hard to believe?
It is. Makes me feel really old.
Doesn't it? But you did have a daughter what was your daughter's name? Excuse me, but I forgot, and that's my fault.
The daughter that I had when he was alive, her name is Bri.
Bri, that's right. Now, you didn't know quite how to finish the book, so I think you set it aside for a while. Is that correct? Am I following this going in the right direction here?
Yes. I didn't feel like the ending had happened yet,
mm-hmm.
and so I had to wait until I felt like it was there. So I felt like we came full circle and I finished, and the story was finished
mm-hmm.
somewhat. And so it took 11 years for that to happen.
Okay.
But it eventually did, and I knew it. It hit me right in the face when it happened. So.
Okay. And I think that it is really, I don't know if you want to reveal that ending or not, but it is very much tied to your daughter. Is that correct?
Yeah. I don't want to spoil the ending.
Okay, we don't want to spoil the ending.
It is a nice little reveal. It's that TV producer in me.
Okay. Well, we won't spoil the ending, but let me just tell you that when you get to the end of the book and you get to see what took Shirley 11 years to finally find what the ending to the book is, you're probably going to, at least it made me jump for joy with happiness, I have to say. But it also, my mouth dropped. I'm like, oh, my God, that little turd, Corey, look at him, you know, because it just kind of made me laugh about him, because I just figured, of course, he's like a little Houdini, okay, but it was just a marvelous ending, and so it brought the joy back into my heart, and it kind of helped me to, you know, breathe again, because honestly, during the book, quite often, I was just like, you know, I was just so engaged with the journey that you had taken and the things that Corey I had brought forth, and oh God, the wise things that he said. And I think one of the stories that I thought was so cute, his sense of humor. And again, I'm going from memory here. He, when it was getting towards the end, Corey, normally up until that point, it was hard to keep him down. But it was getting towards the end, and Corey was in a hospital bed in the living room, and didn't he lose his sight, and he was unable to get out of bed, and there was a whole lot of things going on.
Yeah.
And you had been sleeping on the floor somewhere right next to him.
Right.
Never leaving his side, because you knew that the end was coming. But you were walking past your bedroom, and your waterbed was in there, and it looked really inviting to you, so you went in and laid down, and you fell asleep. I'm sorry, but for the sense of humor of it, you know, what happened, that was actually, I laughed out loud. Tell everybody what happened.
He was just so amazing. I did. I just closed my eyes for 2 seconds, and all of a sudden, I could hear him. He had rolled off the bed. It was actually not a hospital bed. It was just a box spring and mattress. And because I didn't want to put him up in his room away from everybody.
Sure.
And he'd rolled off the bed and literally crawled to my bedroom looking for me. And so I looked over the side of the bed and I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, just cruising around, you know, got tired of being in the bed." And he didn't want to make me feel bad, but he was actually looking for me.
Uh-huh.
And he was just so swollen. And he lost the vision in one eye because his the ventricles of his brain were filled with leukemia cells, which put pressure on the different nerves. And so
uh-huh.
they didn't operate correctly. If he pried his eye open, he could see. But
uh-huh.
he couldn't get the message to his eyelids to open.
Uh-huh.
And so he was just not doing very well. And so for him to have done that was incredible, because he had to crawl from the living room, through the dining room, through the kitchen, down the hallway, and into my bedroom.
Right.
And there he was.
And he was just out cruising. There was no
he was just out cruising.
He was just out cruising, Mom. No big deal, right?
Then there was a time right around the same time where I caught him trying to get into a dining room chair.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "Honey, what are you doing?" And he said, "Well, you know, I kind of want to eat at the table. I'm sick of eating in bed." Well, I had these really lightweight wooden chairs, and, you know, he could have very easily fallen. And so I knew that he really, this is something that he needed for his own dignity. So I helped him get up into the chair. And he only lasted about, I don't know, 45 seconds before he said, "Okay, I'm done." And, you know, then he weighed as much as I did at that point, because he was so swollen from the disease and the Decadron and he was quite a bit shorter than me, but he was round. And so I helped him get back to his bed. But he was just a funny little character.
He was. And even the stories about when the medications they gave him made him very, very hungry, and then he had these things that he wanted to eat, and you were providing him with those. And how he was like, I think the funniest story was he had prepared food, and he had a whole bunch of people coming over, and Corey had disappeared, and all of a sudden you went, oh, no, and you went running into the house, and he had ate all the chicken.
Yeah,
right?
Two chickens.
Yeah.
In one sitting.
In one sitting.
And we didn't have any more money, and all we had was side dishes. So we sent the kids to my mother's house for dinner, and my friends and I sat and ate side dishes.
Right. Corey had a voracious appetite.
He had that, they get cravings from the chemotherapy drugs.
Sure, sure. So that's, I mean, it's so complicated. There's so many different aspects of the side effects and the various different things that he had to deal with and you had to deal with. And even when they told him, he actually put his foot down and he said, I'm not going to take any more treatments. Is that he decided I've had it with the treatments.
Mm-hmm.
And tell him what.
Well, he tried it. He actually asked to quit 3 times.
Right. And you had to fight to get them to stop treating him, didn't you?
They were threatening to take us to court. But the first time he asked to stop, I couldn't support it because I just wasn't ready.
Mm-hmm.
That was before we met Elizabeth. And then when I talked to Elizabeth about it, I felt really guilty. And she said, well, what are you going to do next time he asks? And I said, well, I will try to support him. Mm-hmm. So the second time he asked, his doctor and his dad talked him out of it. And the third time, I supported him, and I called the hospital and said, we're not coming tomorrow. He was just so sick of being sick. And we'd had really bad weather, so he had an extra week between treatments. And he finally had started feeling okay because it had sort of gotten to the point where there was no good time between treatments. And that's when he said, Mom, you know, we talked about quality versus quantity, and mm-hmm. I'm done. And then having a couple days where he felt okay and then thinking tomorrow I'm going to start feeling crappy again, he just said, Mom, I can't do it anymore. He said, I've gone 5 years on treatment for everybody else. Now I want to stop for me.
Right.
And what do you say to that, you know?
Right.
So he, plus I had taught him from the time he was 3 that it was his body, because I believed that he, you know, mind over matter and that kind of stuff. And, you know, but it just wasn't meant to be. Mm-hmm. And so there was also times where I was worried that he would be in the hospital and I couldn't be there the whole time.
Sure.
And I told him, it's your body. They have to respect you. They work for you.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody's doing something to you that you don't like or that you don't understand, you can say, stop. This is my body. You need to stop and explain this or whatever. Wait till my mom gets here. So when he said, I want to stop treatment, he said, well, it's my body.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors were like, well, but you're only 8 years old. And he said, I know, but it's my body.
Mm-hmm.
So when it got closer, I said, yeah, I will support you. And the doctor, especially the oncologist, they just threw a big hissy fit, and
mm-hmm.
they wanted to force it. And I said, no, you know, he's the patient. He deserves respect,
mm-hmm.
just as much as an adult patient.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that he tried to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to have this big meeting, and his stress management doctor supported him. His primary care nurse supported him. The social worker supported him. I supported him, but the oncologist was begging him to continue. And he finally said, doctor, you know, if you can't guarantee that I'm going to live by staying on treatment for another 6 months or a year, then I'm done. He said, because I don't want to die. I'm not saying I choose to die. I'm saying I know I'm going to die anyway, and I want some good time.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So
sure.
As it turns out, he probably had already relapsed at that point,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even knew it, because within weeks he was showing signs of relapse in his central nervous system.
Right. But he still wanted to go to school. He just still wanted life to be as normal as possible.
I offered him Make-A-Wish. I was going to create his own Make-A-Wish. I said, you know, I'll sell the house, take out a loan. What do you want to do? Do you want to go see the Eiffel Tower? Do you want to go to Tahiti and really run on the beach? You know, what do you want to do? And he said, I want to go to school. And I thought, dang, there goes my trip.
There goes my trip.
But he went as long as he could, and it was awesome that the principal, it was a really small alternative school, and a lot of principals would not have allowed a terminal child at school.
Right. You know, but they thought Corey was special from the get-go when he went with school, right? They recognized his unusual abilities.
This particular principal, who now lives in Hawaii, she said that, because it was called a freedom school, And it was pretty chaotic most of the time.
There's a lot of freedom, right?
Yeah. They got to choose the classes each day that they would learn. And, you know, they would fix their own schedule. So, of course, my daughter would go, her schedule would be gym, out, gym, play. And we're going, how is this ever going to balance out? But it somehow managed to. But she said that he would walk into a room that was just exploding with chaos, and it would just calm down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she said he was like a little Jesus walking in, and everything would just sort of mellow out. Mm-hmm. And not that they were, you know, stopping because they were afraid or, you know, whatever. It was even before he was terminal. He just had this ability to bring calm to a situation like that.
And his student and his fellow classmates loved him, and it seemed to almost know something that the rest of the world didn't see in Corey, but it seemed as though they recognized something in him. I mean, kind of like a little walking guru he was.
He was, you know, and a lot of them, you know, I don't even know how many had ever even experienced a death in their family, because this is an elementary school.
Sure.
And he taught them not to be afraid of dying people, you know.
Right.
And it's really cute, because I have a video that we did through the TV station, and one of his friends said, you know, he taught me not to be afraid of dying, because he said everybody's got to die someday. And it was so cute, because that was just out of the mouth of a babe, you know.
Sure, sure. And that's really the attitude that we all need to have, that, you know, you've got to kind of understand what that process is and where you're going and think about those things and be prepared, because everyone, and it's a personal thing, as much as you'd like to, I always think to myself that it's a personal thing. You can't share that experience. Nobody can go with you. It's something you have to do by yourself, you know?
Right.
So preparing the spirit for that is an important aspect of living. But not to live your life to be afraid of dying, because that'll come soon enough, you know? You might as well enjoy every moment that you have, just like Corey so beautifully stated so many times throughout the book. And as I said, this was a child's words throughout the book, but they had the wisdom of the ages interwoven in them. And what he had to say is a message for humanity. It's a message for all of us.
Right.
And it came out of such a young, vibrant, amazing, unique, I don't know how many words he got. I mean, he was an amazing child, and you were an amazing mom. So I do want to just once again remind everyone, and I really can't encourage you enough. I mean, if I could start my own Book of the Month Club, this would be it. This would be definitely the Book of the Month. And so the website, again, is overtherainbowbridge.info. And one of the beautiful things about the website, I think, is if you sit and you just take a moment and you read the testimonials of the various different people that read the book and how the book moved them and how they definitely related to your story and your life and your experience and your emotions, and how they all ended up just wanting to adopt Corey and loved him. And, you know, it's just it must be a wonderful thing to get those kind of testimonials.
You know, it was the first fan letter I got blew my mind. So I thought, oh, wow, look at this. Somebody, a stranger's writing me a note. But it is so gratifying to hear how his message has affected people, because, you know, it's not a book about dying. It's a book about living.
Exactly.
And it's a book about hope, and it's a book about survival. And for people who have lost a child or that are possibly going to lose a child, you know, it's good for them to know that you did survive that.
Sure.
There, you know, people think, oh, my gosh, I could never live through that. Well, you do, and you can, and you have to, you know. So
right.
It's good to hear that people actually do survive and thrive.
Sure.
And, you know, he made me the person that I am today. Our experiences together, if we hadn't had that, I don't know, you know, I know I wouldn't be doing all the community service work that I do.
Sure. But he also was a messenger on a soul level,
mm-hmm.
based on numerology. His purpose in coming in this particular lifetime was to awaken, enlighten, or give a message to humanity on some level. And so his experiences and what he went through was part of that message. And so I really feel as though he fulfilled his life purpose. And by gosh, he got it done in a very short amount of time. Some of the rest of it takes us forever. But Corey got it done quickly because he was in a hurry. I don't mean to say that jokingly, but you know, if you get the essence of Corey as a young child and even in fast forward all of his life, I mean, this child was definitely at a dead run from the get go. So it really does suit him. And I think you're an incredible person, Shirley. And certainly he chose you as his mom. And I am ever very grateful to you for writing this book, and I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. And I actually can't believe that we're out of time. It seemed like we just started talking, right?
Yeah, it does.
Yes, it does. Well, once again, the website is overtherainbowbridge.info. You can order the book there, or you can go to Amazon.com and also order the book. I really encourage everyone to check out the book. It's just inspirational. Shirley, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank
I wish you,
Alice.
Well with the book. I really hope nothing but blessed and wonderful things for you.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you spending time with us and letting me know how much Corey's story affected you.
It was wonderful. All right, honey. Well, God bless, and you have a wonderful evening.
Okay, thanks.
You're welcome. And everyone, I'll be back again next week. I have Gary Wimmer on the show, I believe, and he's going to be doing some readings using stones, so I think that'll be an interesting show. And I thank you all for joining us this evening, and I hope that you found Corey as inspirational as I did. And once again, check out the info tab on Visible by Numbers. You can find the link right to Shirley's website. So thank you, everyone. You all have a wonderful week. I'll see you again next week. And in the meantime, abundant blessings. Good night, everyone.
Thank you for joining us this evening. For more information, or if you wish to contact Allison for a reading, please visit www.visiblebynumbers.com or email Allison at alynch@ptd.net. Have a wonderful evening and be well.